I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you very much for joining us. Today we're going to delve into your DNA, my DNA, probably every person, who knows, every animal, plant, mineral, what have you's DNA, when we start talking about codes. We're going to be talking about the God code and whether or not we get the answers to the questions that we want from this code or not. It is a very intriguing and interesting concept, and I'm sure many people have heard of the Bible code and all of these different things. Well, it's quite related, and my guest, who is also the author of The Zero Point, Greg Braden is my guest. He is the author of The God Code, The Secret of Our Past and the Promise of Our Future. And Greg, welcome to our program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to hear your voice, Richard. Thank you very much for having us back on the program.
Tell me about this whole business of the God code as far, and well, we have a book here, so just read the book and it'll be fine. But actually, give us a synopsis, because a lot of people are extremely intrigued, not only by people such as yourself coming out and talking about, oh, you mean there's a scientifically valid explanation for the connection between man and this supernatural being we call God?
Sure, sure. Well, the book itself, the book, The God Code, and the certainly the topic of our conversation this evening, result from a research project, Richard, that actually began in the late 1980s when I was an engineer in the defense industry in the last years of the Cold War. And it was, and we can talk more about precisely how the project came about and why it came about. But the from that time until now, applying the best science that we know today to some of our most cherished and ancient texts and traditions, what the research project has led us to understand is a remarkable discovery linking ancient biblical alphabets, such as biblical Hebrew and Arabic, linking those alphabets to the DNA in every cell of our bodies, to the human genome. And it is through this this very precise link, it's a mathematic link between the letters of the ancient alphabets and the elements of life that exist in every cell of our bodies. It's through this link that we have the opportunity to very precisely, very systematically replace the letters of the DNA with the letters of the ancient alphabet. And lo and behold, as we begin to do this, the DNA in the cells of life begin to spell words, and those words begin to spell sentences, and it is those sentences that have such a potent meaning and are the subject of the controversy regarding what we're now calling the God Code. That's a long answer to a short question. And we covered a lot of ground in those few short sentences.
As an American raised learning English and not really knowing any other languages, growing up hearing my mother speaking Spanish and knowing what I know of the Bible and its language or linguistic origins, could we not sum it up by saying that a lot is lost in translation?
I think it is. And Richard, what I'm going to have to say is what the best biblical scholars of our time will readily admit today is as good as our Western biblical text is, and it is a good text, it simply is incomplete. And we know that it's incomplete because we're beginning to find bits and pieces of our biblical heritage that were edited, that were lost over 1,700 years ago. And we find them in places as diverse as the Dead Sea Scrolls in Qumran and in Israel. Mm-hmm. The Nag Hammadi Library and along the banks of the Nile River in Egypt, and the vaults of the Vatican libraries themselves, we find the actual texts. We know at least 45 books, for example, were edited from our Western biblical text in the year 325 A.D. During the 4th century, the time of the Emperor Constantine. And the knowledge that this information is missing, what it does is it helps us to understand why, in some instances, our Bible seems so fragmented. At the same time, similar process happened to other biblical texts. The Hebrew Bible was edited in much the same way. There are a number of books in the Hebrew tradition that were never canonized, is the term that's used when they're included in the final product.
Right.
So now that all of these texts are coming to light, what they're doing is they're helping us to take what were already very good texts and flesh them out to a greater degree of completeness and understanding, and in doing so, help us to understand ourselves better. And hopefully through that we become better people and we can create a better world through those understandings.
It is, from my perspective, growing up and going through radio in my early days in a religious broadcasting station and learning an immense amount, not just about broadcasting, strangely enough, but also about comparative religions, sociology, philosophy, psychology, and the list goes on. And asking a lot of the quote-unquote tough questions that I was often said, well, go to the writers, the founding fathers, and they have the answers to your questions. And it just raised more questions. Well, who set these guys up as the founding fathers? And why is it that I can't ask these questions and I have to read their answers and that these people I'm talking with can't answer them?
Hmm.
I often found that fascinating. And really, that's kind of where the God Code comes in. Tell us, if you can, the base, the bottom line connection between, and I guess the best way to put it is the Holy Writ, and in the original languages, the connection between that and our what is called DNA. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the full name. I'll just say DNA.
Sure. Richard, well, what's happening, and I'm going to apologize in advance, because if what we do sounds technical, it is it's because of my inability to take what is very simple and very elegant and explain it in a non-technical manner. The relationship we're going to speak about is so direct, it's so straightforward, and at the same time, it's such a very different way of looking at our world. To arrive at the understandings and to make the discovery that we're speaking about tonight, it was necessary to cross the traditional boundaries that separate the sciences of genetics, chemistry, biology, evolution, as well as the sciences of language, of linguistics, crossing those traditional boundaries that have separated them in the past to give us a greater understanding. So to help understand how this discovery has come about, we'll begin simply with language. It's all about language. In Western science today, our science tells us that the universe, our world, our bodies, and all matter as we know it, including life, is what it is because elements have combined in a very specific way, and those elements are cataloged in an alphabet that we call the periodic table of elements. I know everyone who's been in school, or if your children are in school now, you've studied the periodic table of elements, and it describes very, very basic components that make our world what it is today.
It's
things
a very,
like hydrogen.
It's a powerful table, because I got to go to Disneyland in eighth grade when I memorized it.
Oh, really? Well, so there you go. It's elements such as hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, the metals that are familiar to us, gold, silver, copper, those are all part of the periodic table of elements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting is we describe the elements that make up our world through words such as hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen. At the same time, we also assign very specific, very precise numbers to every one of those elements. So we can call them a name, or we can call them a number, and we're still talking about the same thing.
Okay.
Okay, on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, it appears that in at least some ancient traditions, they did precisely the same thing, Richard, that they viewed our world as being made of very precise elements, and every element was assigned a number. And the difference is that at the time in history that we're talking about, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, they did not yet understand or know about words such as hydrogen and nitrogen and oxygen. So they gave the elements different names. However, the numbers remain the same. So in the ancient alphabet of biblical Hebrew, for example, and this research project began with biblical Hebrew, not because it's the oldest alphabet in the world, but because, or rather, because it is the oldest continuously used language, and it has changed so very, very little in the last 5,000 years. It's a very stable language.
Can I ask you a question about
the
language?
Sure, sure.
Okay, as we continue discussing the God Code, and we're talking with Greg Braden, who is my guest from Wisdom Traditions and Beyond. He's written several other books, including Awakening to the Zero Point, which we've spoken with him about in the past, Walking Between the Worlds, and others as well. And I wanted to find out from you if my understanding and maybe others' understandings of the Hebrew language was that each character in the, I believe it's pronounced the alphabet, has its own, shall we say, story, has its own musical tone, has its own numerical rating, if you will, and so on and so forth. And then when you put each of these characters together to make words, it creates its own, another unique combination of tones and numbers and so forth. And then you put those together in sentences. This is why I said earlier in the program that so much is lost in translation because of that relationship. Is my understanding of the language and the alphabet fairly accurate?
Well, precisely, Richard. And it is an example of the mysteries as well as the power of the Hebrew alphabet. And other alphabets as well. But in the Hebrew alphabet specifically, when we go into some of the most cherished traditions, some of the oldest descriptions in the Hebrew traditions of the origins of our universe and subsequently our world and our bodies, we're given a description, a blow-by-blow, step-by-step description of how the universe came into existence and our bodies came into existence by the power or the force of what the texts call God, and God means different things to different people, but precisely how the power of God took these letters and created the universe, our world, and our bodies. To a scientist, that has very little meaning because we all know, at least outwardly, that simply using the letters of an alphabet are not going to create a universe unless those letters are actually symbols that represent something other than what we have commonly understood. And that's precisely what we found, is that the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, every one of those letters has a very precise number associated with it. And to make a long story very brief, what this research project has revealed is that the letters for the numbers for key letters in the Hebrew alphabet are exactly the numbers of what we call atomic mass for the periodic table. So while it sounds very technical, it's actually very simple. Although the alphabets may be represented differently, the numbers, underlying numbers, never changed. So it's simply by matching the numbers of the DNA, the elements of the DNA, the atomic mass, with the numbers of the Hebrew alphabet, that we are given the instruction to substitute or replace the letters into the DNA. And when we do that, this is where the words appear, and from the words subsequently the sentences. And among the words that we're finding are literally the ancient name of God encoded into the cells of our bodies, hence the title of the book, The God Code.
All right, well, let me see if I can get some time markers from you then.
Sure.
Rough time markers, the age or the birth, if you will, of the Hebrew language, as we're referring to it today.
We really don't know. As far we have evidence the Hebrew language goes back at least 5,000 years. What we know is that it's been very stable. In other words, very few changes in the language for at least the last 3,000 years.
Okay, now, how about the periodic table? The elements have been around ever since the universe has been in existence.
Right.
However, man is the one who came up with the names and the atomic numbers and so forth.
Right.
So how long has that been around?
Well, the periodic table is an ongoing development process. Just as a matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, two new elements were added to the periodic table.
Oh, no, not two more to memorize.
And, but the periodic table is an outgrowth of the scientific method, and science and the scientific method, as we know it today, is only about 400 years old.
Okay. And so when you start taking the periodic table, and I'm curious, too, if there are two new elements that have been added, mm-hmm. what does this do to your code?
As far as I know, it has very little effect on the code. The new elements that were added are elements that were found in a very specific kind of chamber in a physics laboratory after bombarding atoms and splitting them apart for several weeks under artificial conditions that we don't typically find in nature. These elements were revealed, and they last so very, very briefly. I mean, just fractions of a nanosecond, then they're gone. And they have to add them to the periodic table. But what we know is there are about 96 stable elements, naturally occurring elements in the periodic table that we find in Earth. Of those 96, 21 elements are required for the human body. And those have been around for a very long time. And the key elements, the four key elements, are the ones we've mentioned earlier, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon.
Now, you've been a senior computer systems designer, you've been a geologist, a technical operations supervisor at Martin Marietta and so forth. What went through your mind that brought these two elements together, the Bible or in the original languages, and the periodic table of elements, i.e. the DNA?
Sure.
I mean, I guess I would have had to gone through the various careers that you did for something like that to click in my head, saying, you know, there's got to be a connection there, because off the top, there's no connection for me.
Well, it's an interesting question, and I to be honest, Richard, I didn't think much about it until I started hearing the question frequently in interviews and in front of live audiences. People typically ask me the question, what was it that led you to the leap, the quantum leap, between the world of science and the world of these ancient texts? And I guess I was a little surprised when I first heard the question, because for me it was less of a leap and more of a logical progression. In my way of looking at things, as we study the world around us, we understand the intelligence that underlies creation and ultimately the creative force itself, and science is the way that we've done that. So as a child, I made the connections in one way. As an adult, I made them another way. But for me, the world of science and the careers as well have always been a path to understand the creative intelligence that underlies our existence. So when I began referencing ancient texts that take us one step further, they not only state that there is a creative intelligence underlying our existence, they begin to describe literal descriptions in terms of how that intelligence went about creating our world and our bodies. And what I did was I simply went back to some very rarely referenced texts, and some of them have been translated into English very few times, such as the Hebrew Sefer Yetzirah is the name of the specific text. And it's through those texts they actually describe the process, and I simply applied the best science of our time to what that process suggested, and this brought us to the point where we are today. We now have a portion of the code.
Has there been any major revelation out of this code that is going to be changing the ways in which people believe and or worship and or express their spirituality based upon the way that they were raised, in opposition or as opposed to maybe the way that they were raised?
Sure.
Is there anything that basically there might be some scholar out there saying, we've got to shut Greg Braden up because he could undermine Christianity and other religions with this God code hocus pocus stuff?
Well, you just asked three questions in that question. So what I'll say, let me answer the last one first. It's been very interesting. The book has been out for review for a number of months, even before it was released in February of 2004. And the fact that a message exists in the cells of our bodies, and I'm going to share a portion of that message during this program, the fact that that message is there has not been disputed in the scientific or the technical community. Once they have seen the methodology and the systematic nature of how we go about finding this message. It's not like we have to jiggle a number here and fudge a number there. Mm-hmm. It's once we apply these relationships, the words, I mean, the DNA becomes words. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. So the controversy has not been as to whether or not the message exists. The controversy has been as to how it got there, who put it there, where it came from, how long it's been there, and what it means in our lives. But the interesting thing, Richard, is that as different as the spiritual traditions and the many religions appear from one another today, the communications I've had with people from those different traditions have all said to me that this discovery supports their belief. It supports their tradition. It supports the premise of their spirituality, and that premise is that there is an intelligence that underlies our existence, that we're here on purpose, and that that intelligence is part of who we are, not something in the world beyond us, that we're literally part of that intelligence. So it's interesting, although the Mormon tradition and the Native American tradition, the Catholic Church and the Hebrew traditions and the Muslim traditions are also different from one another, people from those traditions have spoken with me directly and said that this supports the fundamental premise of their belief that we're part of something greater.
And you made a comment earlier about how the elements come together to form whatever it is that they form, and they just don't come together arbitrarily or accidentally, as you described it. They are engineered by a greater intelligence. Ergo, I find it, from a logic standpoint, illogical to think that all of this is an accident. Mm. Because if it were, then from my perspective, my life has no meaning.
What a marvelous accident, if it were.
Indeed.
What I'd like to do, let me, if I may.
Yes.
Let me describe the way the message exists in ourselves, mm-hmm. and subsequently what the message is that's been discovered so far.
But just before you get to that, I want to remind our listeners that we are talking with Greg Braden, author of The God Code, and we are going to hear from him right now about the message contained within the code and within our own DNA. And with that, I'm going to let you just expound for the next few moments.
Sure. Well, thank you, Richard. And from that, then I will be able to address the comment and the question you made earlier about the intentionality, mm-hmm. of this message. Is it possible this could be a fluke? Because we all know if we pull enough letters out of a phone book or a Sears catalog or War and Peace, enough random letters are eventually going to form words. Is it possible that this could just be a fluke? And once we understand what the message is, I can share statistically how significant the message is. So what I'll do is invite the listeners just for a moment, if you can envision the cells of your body as each cell as a library, a literal library containing information. And within each library, each cell in our body, scientists tell us that we have 23 pairs or 46 chromosomes. If we can think of those chromosomes as books in the library, and if we can think of the DNA that makes those chromosomes as chapters within the books, we begin to get a feel for how this information is stored in the cells of our bodies. And at the beginning of almost every book that you find in the library or on your bookshelf, the book begins with a preface or an introduction. It appears that our cells work precisely the same way. At the uppermost layer, the topmost layer of the code, the message in the cells of our bodies, is the same for all of us. So when we apply the discovery of the relationship between ancient alphabets and the DNA in our bodies, the introduction into every cell of our bodies literally translates into the English language as the words God eternal within the body. God eternal within the body is the literal translation of the first layer of the message in the cells of life. It appears that the message occurs in many, many layers. and each layer has its own unique code to translate that layer. And it took 12 years to find the first code, and that code has revealed the brief yet very potent message, God eternal within the body. Subsequent layers are being translated and verified, and if we were to have this interview 6 months from now, I know that we would know now than we know right now.
Now, when you say God eternal within the body, and I, my original question, or one of my questions to you, having to do with causing dissension within the ranks of the religious, this might very well be a bone of contention, because most people are taught that God isn't within us, but he's up in the sky somewhere. He's this white-haired, white-robed gentleman up there, meeting out benefits and judgment. And so he's not within us. So
and there's a key word in the sentence that you just shared, Richard, and that's that most people are taught through the interpretations. However, when you get down to the essence of the original texts, the texts themselves are very clear that literally heaven lives within our bodies, that God lives within our bodies, and that we are part of the world around us and part of all that we see. Whether it's a Christian traditions or whether it's the Native American traditions or the Buddhist traditions, the texts all say something very similar. It's the interpretations that came later.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the value of going back into the original versions of the documents, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Hebrew Torah, the supplemental documents. And thus far, what I'll say is that there has not been any dissension or any problem with interpretation. And I just did this program in New York City, and it was interesting because there were Orthodox Jewish people in the audience, and they certainly had questions regarding the Hebrew language and how that language is translated via the cells in our bodies. But in terms of what the message said to us, there thus far anyway, there has been no problem with that whatsoever. And I think this is the key, that a discovery is only as good as the context within which it's revealed. And I know this firsthand, because I have had the opportunity to walk into a room full of people and share with them the fact that a text message, lives within all life. And it's such a huge concept, Richard, it doesn't have much meaning. So for that reason, when I put the book together, I gave a context. The book is divided into three sections, and the first section describes our world today and the consequences of our failure to overcome, to transcend the differences between us, and to learn ways to solve our problems through something other than warfare. The middle section describes the discovery itself and the charts and the diagrams of how this message comes about. And the third section is how we apply it in our lives and what it means. And I think it is that context now that gives such significance to this discovery, because in the first 3 years of the 21st century, the best minds of our time, social architects, historians, political leaders, as well as spiritual leaders, are all saying essentially the same thing, that the greatest threat to our species right now is not a virus, it's not a rogue disease or an asteroid coming from space. The greatest threat is humankind and our propensity to solving our problems through warfare and to making ourselves appear different from one another, differences of wealth, of race, of heritage, of bloodlines, and the warfare being based upon those differences. So at the very least, the discovery of a message in the cells of all humans that reads the same says to us that we may not be so very different from one another after all. It gives us a reason to think about ourselves differently.
Indeed. It reminds me, tells you what era I grew up in, reminds me of an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation. They find these little pieces of DNA throughout the galaxies, and different races happen to find different pieces, and they start putting these pieces together. They finally encode the final piece. Suddenly this hologram of this individual appears and says, by virtue of my being here and you're hearing and seeing me, means that you have gotten together and you've realized that you are all of the same code, so to speak, in essence.
You know, I have to—I've got to admit, I have never seen that episode, and I've had a number of people come to me in the live events, both here and overseas, talking to me about that episode. Do you know which?
Well, it was
which
the,
episode was it? Toward the end of the series, or was it the
next?
Beginning,
it was the Next Generation series, and it may have been towards the end, maybe the second to last season. The real irony, of course, was that turns out instead of gathering together, oh my gosh, look what we've done, they went off still enemies in many cases.
I see. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they didn't. That's all there was, you know, and there was nothing more. It was not a great weapon. And that seems to be the unfortunate thing that I'm hoping that your message, but the message you have discovered will not fall on deaf ears, will fall upon the right ears, the ears of those who have the opportunity to make change, to evoke change. And sometimes I wonder if it isn't just you and me.
Well, what I'll say is this message at least has intrigued people tremendously. Mm-hmm. The book has been very well supported. The first print run sold out in about 8 weeks. And it wasn't. It was all over the world. And what it tells me is that the premise of this book and the fact that it is nonfiction has touched something within people in a way that is meaningful to them. What they do with that meaning remains to be seen. But one of the things it was so as I was researching the book, and I describe what I'm about to share with you. I describe in the first section of the book. I had the opportunity to look at what historians now say about the century that passed. We all live through this, the 20th century and the birth of this 21st century, so we don't have to speculate. We can go back and look at the statistics that historians have compiled. And the one that surprised me the most was that the 20th century was, bar none, the single bloodiest century in all of recorded human history on a per capita basis when they take into account the ratio of people existing in the world then and now, that it was bloodier than any time the Romans or the Inquisitions, any time. And the reason that was given for the justification of those kinds of statistics was simply that people were different from one another, that they believed differently. The color of their skin, of their heritage, again, of their bloodlines or their religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that this is so important is because in the first 3 years of the 21st century, the thinking that led to those statistics is still in place. And what I had the honor of sharing the stage with some amazing scientists, engineers, social architects the last couple of years, and although they all speak about different things, what they're saying in common is that it's the next 10 to 15 years of our time in this world, they say, are the most critical. If humankind can get through this next 10 to 15 years without another global war using the awesome technology that we now have at our fingertips, that we have a wonderful future awaiting us. And they all say that what stands between us and that wonderful future of a world with very little disease and a world of cooperation and a world of peace, they say it's the threat of war and our propensity to solve our problems through war.
Yeah.
And then the statistics went on. As I was compiling the information for the book, as of the year 2002, nearly one half of the world's nations are engaged in armed conflict. Not all of them are declared wars. So people are still losing their lives. And the United States right now has troops on the ground in at least 22 different countries. And it invites us to look at the parallels and the possibilities and ask ourselves, are we on a dangerous course? If we are, can we make the choices now to avoid some of the most dire consequences? And I think we need a reason to see ourselves differently. And the fact that the message exists within the cells of life is a place to begin with that reason.
Indeed, it's a similarity we all, and all is very inclusive, that we all share.
Mm.
I guess the response I would have, and it kind of flashed in my mind as you were speaking of this, was, well, I guess what it really comes down to is that we just all need to behave.
Well, it's interesting. In the last 2 years, with the exception of Antarctica, I've not done any programs or toured Antarctica, but I've been on every continent of the Earth, with the exception of Antarctica. And what I've found is that the people of this world are ready for peace. Even those who have been angry in the past, they're ready for peace by large. And there are a relatively few number of people that that believe the way to that peace is through the kinds of warfare we've had in the past. So I think everyone's looking for peace, more or less. They have different ways of going about it, and I think some of the ways simply have become obsolete. Warfare meant something different 100 years ago than it means today.
Yes, yes.
And I think it's a great lesson. It's a very potent lesson. I believe that humankind, I think we are learning that lesson, and I'm an optimist. I'm very optimistic by some of the changes I'm seeing, and at the same time, for whatever reason, I can't explain the reason why, but I think as a species, we've chosen a very difficult path and a difficult way to go about learning the lesson, and I think there's been infinitely more suffering and bloodshed than there needed to be, and I think we're going to see some more in the near future before it gets better.
And that's an unfortunate thought, but unfortunately the realities are.
It is, and the reason is because two realities are overlapping right now, and what we're seeing is a clash of the realities and ways of addressing the problems. One way that was proven over the last 400 or 500 years, another way that doesn't make a lot of sense to traditionalists. And it's an amazing time. It's a fascinating time to be alive. And again, I'm an optimist, and I have tremendous faith in our species and in our willingness to adapt. On the one hand, and on the other hand, it has been a sad and very painful road that's brought us to this point.
Now, Greg, you can hear me pretty well right now, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. And so we're using a technology that is in one sense, very profound. I mean, you could either be, Washington, D.C., or Los Angeles, or Moscow, or even at the North Pole, and probably would have almost as clean and clear a signal as that we have.
Yes.
And yet, this message... And I found this fascinating in my own studies years ago. This message that you have found, this correlation between the God code and our own DNA, I found interesting as I would study my own Bible in the New King James Version. I often say to people, well, the rest of the epistles could have been, they wouldn't have been needed if people had just gotten a message in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It would have ended with the book of Acts, possibly.
Sure.
In that kind of context. When you talk about the message and that the next, you say the scientists, many of these people that you are involved with, say that it's the next 10 or 15 years that are the real critical, if we can get through them. Mm-hmm. Have they defined get through, meaning that we survive as a species, we don't annihilate ourselves?
Well, it's more than simply survival. There's a brilliant physicist who's the co-author of the latest theory in physics called the superstring theory. His name is Dr. Michio Kaku. He teaches out of New York University. I've had the honor of sharing a stage with him a number of times. He's written a book entitled Visions, where he interviewed 125 scientists, some of the leading thinkers of our world from every nation you can imagine. It's not just American scientists. And asked them what they saw for the future of humankind and the future of the Earth. And all of them foresaw a time when disease is essentially non-existent, when we tap the fundamental forces of nature for our energy needs rather than relying on limited amounts of fossil reserves, when humankind is exploring the stars even beyond our solar system. And they all said that before we can get to that point, we have got to overcome this period in time where we're locked into what they call violent competition for limited resources and feeling that some people are more deserving of those than others. So it's more than simply surviving that time. It is transcending the limitations that we have placed upon ourselves in the past, and doing that within that time period. And I think the reason they chose, now they didn't specify this to me personally, but my sense is the reason they chose that time period is because our technology has advanced so quickly in terms of the kinds of weapons that we now have at our fingertips, that if we were to incorporate that kind of technology into the warfare today, rather than eliminating an army, we're talking about eliminating an entire civilization in a matter of days or weeks. And I think that is what the timing is all about. If we can get through this next 10 to 15 years without doing something like that.
I know that there are a lot of people who are really wanting us to rise above, to ascend to a new level, and they speak of it more on a spiritual level. And so there are those of that ilk who basically that's what they're looking for. They're looking for that higher connection and hopefully sharing that with other people. Mm-hmm. And that's where the spirituality comes in. That's where the God code is. It's interesting to me because, as you say, it's not just in the writings of the Bible. It's in the writings of many of the holy texts, if you will, the scriptures of many religions.
And the oral traditions of many of the indigenous people, whether it's the Aboriginals or Tibetans or Native North or South Americans.
And now you've made a connection between the spiritual and the scientific in terms of the DNA code and the periodic table. And I've had an opportunity over the last few years to do some research, some study, some experiencing and so forth within other spiritual traditions, such as one in particular, Tantra, you may be familiar with.
Sure. And we're less than a month back from India, where many of those traditions were actually originated in northern India.
So there's a connection, another area, and you went into a new realm that's just now being, I guess, discovered and so forth, but one that we've heard over and over again, quantum physics, mm-hmm. you know, and I am not... I have a real loose understanding. Quantum physics is over my head by light years, but nonetheless, it's a high science as I see it. Tantra, to me, is a high spiritual practice. What about the connection? Is there a similarity in connections between these? In particular, from there's a specific book that I've had an opportunity to go through, and it's called The Spell of the Sensuous by David Abram. And he talks about this connection between quantum physics and spirituality, or Tantra in this case.
Sure. Before the God Code, there was our book prior to that was called The Isaiah Effect. It was based on a little piece of the great Isaiah scroll that was the only completely intact scroll discovered among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the principle of the Isaiah Effect ties into the answer of the question you're asking me, because what quantum physicists say today is that there is a force, an unconventional force, a non-conventional form of energy that permeates all of creation. It exists everywhere all the time. It's been here from the very beginning, the time that physicists call the Big Bang, and that this force has intelligence, that the force literally responds to very specific forms of human emotion in ways that we're only beginning to understand. So quantum physics and quantum physicists are occupied with the understanding and the validation of the force itself on the one hand. On the other hand, many ancient teachings and texts and traditions, including Tantra, take us one step further. They acknowledge that force is there, and rather than simply stating that it's there, they developed an internal science in terms of how we can deal with that force, how we can apply it in our lives. Tantra is one mode of that internal science. Prayer is another mode, and there are different modalities of prayer, and we discuss those, some known better than others, in the book The Isaiah Effect. And why they work the way they work, and step by step, how we apply that in our lives. So there is definitely a link in that. Many of the ancient traditions give us the instruction sets in terms of how to apply this unifying force in our lives, once again, hopefully to help us become better people. And as we become better people, the world around us becomes a better world. So that's a long answer to a short question.
Well, we've gone three quarters of the way through our interview, and certainly you have a great passion for this subject, for this information, for this discovery, and the research. And I guess at this point, what I want to know is why? Why do you care? Why does this matter? What is it that has propelled you into this arena? I mean, I'm curious, and I've done a lot of reading, and I love reading books such as yours and talking with folks like you who are researching these kinds of things and asking the questions. But you're not just asking the questions. You're answering some of the questions that you and I and everyone else are asking as well.
Well, Richard, I'm glad you saved the easy questions for the last. You know, the answer to that question goes back to the first 5 minutes of our interview. This research project began when I was working in the last years of the Cold War. I was working on a project called the MX missile, the Peacekeeper missile.
I remember.
And for people, listeners that work behind the scenes during the Cold War, although it wasn't as public of a war as Vietnam or World War II or Korea, nonetheless, it was a very frightening war. And it is perhaps surprising to some people how very, very close the superpowers came to doing the unthinkable during that time in our history. And it was during that time, myself as well as other colleagues, we asked the question as to whether or not we felt that we were an intentional species. Did we feel that we were here by accident, as a fluke, or is there an intentionality to our being here? And if we are an intentional species, it would make tremendous sense that at some point in our past, we would have been left a clue by the Creator, whoever that be, that once recognized, once we saw this clue, that we could not miss it, couldn't be overlooked, we couldn't deny it, a clue as to our intentionality. And with that clue, maybe we would never find ourselves in the kind of war that we were in during the Cold War or that dominated much of the 20th century. That maybe by finding a clue as to our intentionality, it would shift the way that people view one another, because the wars are based on our differences. And if we can find a principle, a unifying principle that includes everyone, no matter what they believe, no matter what their lifestyle or how they live their lives, no matter what their age or their borders or their bloodlines or their heritage, if we could find a clue that touched everyone in the same way, a verifiable, concrete, tangible proof, then maybe that would be a place to begin to help us to become greater than the differences that have separated us in the past. So that is the impetus that began the project. For me personally, I'm rarely asked that question in an interview, so I rarely have the opportunity to give the answer. And I'll just say to you, I love this world, and I love the people of this world. I've traveled and met people from many different cultures, and while some of them I'd never want to live full time mm-hmm. in those cultures or those countries. I like knowing they're there. I love their history. I love the diversity. And truly, as a species, diversity is our greatest strength. The very thing that makes us feel so separate from one another is the single principle that promises that we're going to be around for a long time, because it's through our diversity that we find our strength. And it's because of my love for our diversity and the people of this world that I felt if I could contribute in some way to finding a universal principle in my lifetime, I'd certainly like to be able to offer and share that.
So then that which doesn't kill us will make us stronger as a species.
That's my prayer, and I'm going to emphasize this was done from a strictly non-religious, non-denominational perspective. The term God just happens to be the term that this portion translates to in English. But one of the interesting things I found, Richard, was that once we did the translation in Hebrew, because it was an accessible, stable, continuously used language, and we understood how the code worked, we were able to branch out and try it in other languages. And lo and behold, the next language was Arabic. And And I talk about this in the book. The message exists in our cells. It translates into either Hebrew or Arabic. So in the languages of the two people today who are having some of the greatest challenges coexisting, they preserve in the cells of their bodies the message that tells them that they aren't so different from one another. And I think that's a powerful message.
How much of the code has been, shall we say, decoded? I mean, is there a way to codify that?
Sure. What we know is this. The introduction into our cells is an admittedly brief message and potent. God eternal within the body. Wow. I mean, the fact that that message exists and reads as it does is just mind-boggling to a scientist. Now, as we're looking into the deeper layers of the code, the sentences literally become hundreds of letters long. And for each of those sentences, I've got to have them validated and confirmed by the geneticists and the linguists who are helping to validate and confirm this information. That's the process that's ongoing right now. and we don't know what we know that the sentences, we can tell where they begin, where they end, how many letters are in them, and we're still confirming the content.
How is this project or this investigation, this research being supported and or funded?
It's all through my personal passion to do precisely this. I took months off in 2001, 2002, and did nothing, very unstructured blocks of time, looking for professionals to help me in my work in further reducing the code into something that was readable and manageable. But it has been a labor of love, and now that we understand how it works, I think there's much more there for us. And what all the audiences are asking now, they're happy to know about the first layer of the message. They're all saying, what's next? What's the rest of it say?
And I'm sure that it's going to be even more profound than what you've already found, although that's a pretty profound message in and of itself right there.
Well, thank you. And it's interesting. It appears that this introduction is the same across all forms of life, whether it's a blade of grass or a fruit fly.
That was my next question, is what do the other DNA codes read?
Well, I haven't had the chance to see all DNA code. And for the ones that we have seen, it suggests that we are all part of the same force because the message is there. However, now that we know what the message is, God eternal within the body appears to be concentrated greater in a human body than it is in a blade of grass, for example. So there is a God eternal in the blade of grass. It doesn't say so much God eternal within the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. We don't know exactly what that means. It's just the way that the statistics are coming up right now.
Mm.
But at the very least, three things we can say. At the very least, this message says to us, because it is statistically significant, it's not an accident, it says that we're here on purpose, that we're no accident, that there is an intelligence underlying our existence, number one. Number two, that all life sharing the message is related. So we're part of one another. We're a family.
Mm-hmm.
And we're part of all life. And number three, the fact that there's a greater intelligence responsible for the message suggests that we are very probably related to something greater than we've ever even allowed ourselves to imagine in the past. And I think we're just beginning. I think this is opening the door for a very empowering way of for humankind to view themselves.
Now, you've obviously traveled around the world, as you just mentioned, coming back a week or so from India, speaking to hundreds, thousands of people, doing interviews such as this. But do you see this message, this initial top layer message, as something noteworthy for more of the media to take note of? My gosh, this is the equivalent of finding extraterrestrials that we're able to communicate with who are giving us messages that the government isn't covering up.
Well, in a very real sense, you know, we've spent a lot of money. Carl Sagan talked about this a lot, looking for incoming messages from beyond our world. In a very real sense, this is a message that has lived within each of us. We've each preserved the message in the same way from another intelligence from another time. What's happening, some media has been very receptive. The book has only been out about 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
It sold out in the first print run, sold out in 8 weeks. Many of the mass media, television particularly, they they like the book, they like the concept, they don't know how to pitch it. They don't know if they should pitch it from an archaeological perspective or anthropological or philosophical or theological perspective. And I think, to be honest, I think they want to see how the book is received before before they take it to a broader audience.
Interesting.
And I think that's happening now. Radio has been tremendously responsive. Audiences have been good all over the world. And local TV has done really well. The Fox, the CBS affiliates in cities in the eastern and in Midwest, eastern part of the U.S. and Midwest. National media, they're interested. They're watching. And I think a lot of this, they'd like to see how it's received by a broad general public.
Finally, before we close out this program, Greg, obviously you're going to continue to work on the code and to go through more of the layers and layers, and it sounds to me like this could take literally years to do with the groups of people involved and the texts that you're dealing with. And, of course, who knows how many more elements they're going to discover. They found two more this week, and they're going to find six more next week. You just never know. But aside from that little hobby, what else do you find time to do?
This has consumed my life. It's the research project has ebbed and flowed with the availability of technology and personnel and the willingness of people to corroborate and work with me since the late 1980s. Beginning in 2000 with the release of the human genome map, where we could start working with this, it has occupied pretty much full-time my life, with the exception of the lecture tours that accompany this and the research trips into Tibet, Egypt, Nepal, India, as we just mentioned, Bolivia, Peru, Thailand, where we're looking into the ancient cultures for the clues that help us to reach the understandings such as we have today. And just to address the statement prior to that, this could take a lifetime, is while the first versions of this code are all done manually, once we understand how they work, the computer algorithms are going to help this to go much, much quicker. And I think it may not take as long. It's a lot of work, and I think it may not take as long as we might think it does. So again, if we were to have this interview in 6 months from now, I think we would know now, midsummer, late summer, we would know more then than I can, I'm able to share right now.
I'd love to touch base with you again in 6 months or a year, just see what the progress is and continue and continued success in this project as well, because we all would do well to heed this initial message and acknowledge that by treating one another, let alone ourselves, understanding that message is within our own code, if we would keep that in the forefront of our minds, we might treat ourselves and one another better.
That's my prayer. And before we close out tonight, Richard, I just want to thank you for being such a gracious host and for your vision and your dedication to keep a program like this going so that we can have a forum to have this kind of conversation. So thank you for all that you do so very well as well.
Thank you. Greg Braden has been my guest with Wisdom Traditions, author, a lecturer, a scientist. The list kind of goes on and on and on. He's the author of the current book that has just been released, The God Code, which also subtitled The Secret of Our Past, The Promise of Our Future. And folks, I want to have a future. And I promise you that I know my wife and others that we will share this with are going to keep this this initial top layer, I'll call it the top layer message, in the forefront of our minds. And Greg, thank you once again.
Many blessings. Thank you for a great evening.
I'm Richard Dugan, and thank you for joining us.